Tonight on Arena, it's reviews this evening as we look at Tuesdays with Murray on stage and new albums from Taylor Swift, Pillow Queens, Wallace Bird and Pearl Jam. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. And yes, what a week we have had of albums, and what a big surprise we got last night. What a literary crowd, in fact, we have in our album slot this evening. Some of the artists giving more than a little nod to poets and poetry. Taylor Swift is one of them, as our latest studio album is called The Tortured Poets Department. Now, is that a reference to Dead Poets Society? Does it in fact refer to a similarly titled WhatsApp group that her ex-boyfriend, Conversations with Friends, Joe Alwyn, shares with Irish actors Paul Mescal and Andrew Scott? That was originally called Tortured Man Club. Look at the literary sleuths that we have been overnight. And not only is Taylor giving us the Tortured Poets Department, we're getting 31 tracks in total, which is more than a double album, I would even hazard to say. Then we have Dublin band Pillow Queens releasing a third studio album, Name Your Sorrow. Title references one of our late great poets, Evan Boland. Wexford singer Wallace Bird has also been digging back into the archives of great literary and musical women in her collaboration with the German classical quintet Spark, and the album is called Visions of Venus. And finally, grunge rockers Pearl Jam have also a displaying of a Dead Poets vibe, musing that their new album Dark Matter, when they say it channels the shared spirit of a group of lifelong creative brothers.
Yeah.
There you go. Will I go home now or will we keep going?
Oh yeah, you're done now. Game, set, match.
Right, let us start with Taylor Swift. I should say, of course, that Simon Marr and Kate Brennan Harding are with me in studio this evening. How surprised were we overnight by the arrival of this Taylor Swift mammoth anthology? In fact, she's calling it not an album, not even a double album, an anthology.
It's an anthology, and it is something that all Taylor Swift fans will just gobble up, delighted with life.
They've been doing nothing all day but listening to the 31 tracks, yes, I would hazard to say.
I don't know whether, you know, the parts of this album, the original first part of the album was actually leaked online a couple of days ago, and the Swifties were devouring that. So maybe she thought, right, I better release the full anthology to let them pick apart and vulture all over the gossip and juicy spiciness that is on this album.
Yeah, because it does concern, she has said on more than one occasion, please can I have some private space for my private life?
Yeah.
But meanwhile, let me give you 31 tracks all about my private
life. And when she announced it, it's a 2 a.m. surprise and said that we were getting 15 more. But it's that whole world, and there's a quote in the press blurb that goes along with it. I've released these 15 extra songs and now the story isn't mine anymore. It's yours, Sean. It's yours. So we all get this. But there's a lot of stories that she has here, and she says
she has
a lot of things to say about a lot of people who she's been involved with. So while previous albums would have been filed under fiction, this is distinctly in the land of non-fiction and named individuals most of the time.
Yeah, so we're talking essentially about whom are the big breakups that she's dealing with here?
Well, so she had a 6-year relationship with Joe Alwyn, the actor. She
Conversations with Friends, Joe Alwyn.
Yes, she had a somewhat. A lot of people did not like that she had a rumoured fling with Matt Healy of the 1975. They were friends for such a long time, and then last year there was lots of pictures of them coming in and out of nightclubs, and people were like outraged that she was hanging out with Matt Healy. But there's definitely songs in there about him, but there's an awful lot about Joe. And like she said herself in one of her press releases, that this is a purge, that this is cathartic. I would say that most of her albums and most of what she writes about are a purge and cathartic. I do love that line, it's all yours, because she knows she's literally sending it off for people to just run amok with it.
In fact, you've been having some fun with one of the titles and the typefaces, but we will come to that in just a minute, Kate Brennan Harding. This is how the anthology opens.
I was supposed to be sent away to you sometimes as
a And there we go, the opening track, Fortnite, featuring Post Malone, I should have said, going into that track from Taylor Swift's new album, our new anthology, The Tortured Poets Department. What are we hearing musically in this, Simon?
We're hearing a lot, like, if you've listened to sort of Midnights or you've listened to Evermore or any of that, there's something very, very familiar about this, you know, that sort of national connection that there was going back with Aaron Dessner and all that stuff over the last few years. There's a lot of that goes through this, and to a point where I found that by about song number 27, you know, even as I was trying to scribble down notes on songs, I was like, hang on, does that sound, is that the thing that was from the first track, or is that track number 17 that I heard there, you know? So there's a lot of that sort of wistful, soft percussion, all of that that's going on here.
Yeah, and Post Malone features on that particular track. Do we hear much of Post Malone?
No, not really. I think what I was saying earlier to you is that Post Malone features on that track, but it's all more in a production kind of capacity and just sort of slight posty things that Post Malone fans would know or recognise, little nuances. I think as well, I was giggling there when Simon was saying about when you got to track 21, because by that stage I felt like I was in a fever dream, because I was like, am I in her world? You know, it's very... like Jack Antonoff and Aaron Dessner have been longtime collaborators with her. Jack Antonoff, I think you can actually hear a difference with the Aaron Dessner tracks and the Jack Antonoff tracks. Like there's one, So Long London, and that is worked with Aaron Dessner. That's the main goodbye to her relationship because she moved to London to be with Alwyn. So when you listen to that one, there is a little bit more of an upbeat kind of thing in it.
Yes.
When I say upbeat, not really.
Although, because there's quite a melancholy feel off a lot of the tracks.
Yeah.
But I love the way this track opens, actually. To be your odd man out. You made a wonderful observation as we listened to the opening of that track that I like, So Long London from Taylor Swift's new album, which was Kate Brennan Harding.
Oh, was it the observation that it sounds, first of all, like she went to a lot of church?
Yeah, because that opening section is like a choral opening, it really is.
Beautiful. And the other observation, when the beat kicks in, it reminds me of London nightlife, of going out in that pulsating beat of the city when you're just about to
head out. could hear the sound of London.
Yeah.
Now, I did mention earlier on that you had been doing some calligraphic, is that the right way of saying it? Detective work.
Well, I say I have. I just went online and I thoroughly, what I'm enjoying, I know I'm supposed to be here music reviewing, but I'm really enjoying looking at all the conspiracy theories and all of the reasons and all of the nuances in this. So there's one song called Thank You, Amy, and the capital letters are only K at the end of thank you, or at the end of thank you, and then I am. And Amy is spelled A-I-M-E-E,
right.
And the I and M. So if you have the capital letters alone, that spells Kim. The song talks about throwing punches and you were always bringing me down when I was building my own self, my own career. And Taylor Swift has had a notorious rift with Kim Kardashian, apparently, down through the years. So this, when you look at it, it spells Kim. And
have
you
been contacted yet about being a handwriting expert
for
crime novels?
I should be. This should be my new career completely. Also, it's more just reading other people's conspiracies and being fascinated by
Okay. However, and I of course, searching through the songs, you know, when I jotted down some of the several titles, you know, Guilty as Sin, I can't fix him. I can do it with a broken heart. The smallest man who ever lived, which I thought was going to be quite an ironic song, but no, it is actually just about it's a small part of my life. I thought it was going to be about something else, totally.
Mm-hmm.
But musically is, I suppose, what we have to talk about. It's hard to do that when you get an album, you know, on a Friday morning, essentially, for us, and you've 31 tracks to get through, Simon. But what did you feel at the end of this?
Yeah, you know, I thought, I get the whole idea of you got to purge and you've got to get all of this stuff out. And she does it in a pleasing way. There is a lot to be liked about Taylor Swift generally and about this album. But as I say, by the time you get to track 27, it does start to get a little bit blurry. The thing that probably kept me interested throughout was the gossip monger in me and kind of going, oh, I wonder if this is the about now. And I didn't even know about Kim Kardashian. And didn't even know half the stories. But there is something about that. There is something about being let in. Yeah. You know, and you know, I probably am being manipulated here. But now that I'm here, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to enjoy this. And the stories in there that are enjoyable are actually very enjoyable.
Okay, stars?
I think it's worth 3.5.
3.5. What are you saying overall then, Kate?
Well, overall, you see, the thing is, right, I don't think that I've had enough time to sit with it. I'm going to give it 3 out of 5. But the one thing that I do really appreciate is I think that Taylor Swift gives a lot of people an access to talk about, you know, their feelings in a way that maybe they just don't have and they can associate with it. And I think it's lovely. And it's a 3 out of 5 so far. A 3 out
yeah,
of 5.
But you have a sense that that might grow as you get time.
By a 0.5 maybe.
Okay. Sorry, I was putting words into your mouth. Putting stars or pulling them out of your mouth. Okay, 3 is what the verdict is from both Simon and Kate on that. Let's move on to Pillow Queens, Name Your Sorrow, title of their latest album, in part inspired, of course, by the late poet Evan Boland's poem, Atlantis, A Lost Sonnet. Just give us that, the specifics of that reference and what they've done with it across this or in this album, Kate.
Yeah, so one of the things that they've done is they've taken the meaning, which is Evan's search for the word, you know, a word that would define what is gone forever and never found. Mm. And when you start listening to this album, you can see that the themes they're looking for as all the different multitudes and ways that we experience loss. Well, that's exactly how I've experienced listening to this album. And so you can see, I think it's weaved throughout without referencing it directly.
And the second track in the album is called Suffer. There we go. A track called Suffer, second track on the new Pillow Queens album, Name Your Sorrow. This is a follow-up, obviously. It's the third album, isn't it, Simon?
Yeah.
The previous being 2020's In Waiting and then 2022 Leave the Light On. Sounds like a major departure, or in fact, I think you're saying it's more like an arrival.
I think it is. I think they're a band who've not necessarily struggled to be where they are, but to work out quite what it is that they want to do. They've always been sort of very tight musically. They've always written very good singles, let's say, but sometimes the albums didn't quite have that coherence, where it just feels like suddenly, when I heard that song before the album came out, there was a couple of singles that were sort of pre-released before it, and it was suddenly as if this is it. It was almost as if they had found a place where they were supposed to be. And whether it is something as simple as bringing in a producer or whether it's something themselves that they kind of discovered as a group, that they figured that this is what we're supposed to do. It's a real step up for them.
Because there's a real... I mean, I always felt there was a kind of a coherence there between the four of them, and with Pamela Connolly and Sarah Corcoran, the two co-lead vocalists here. You also have lead guitarist and vocalist Kathy McGuinness and backing vocalist Rachel Lyons. But there's a real sense of four equals in this album to me.
It's completely cohesive in the way that, like, as Simon was saying, you've got a band that released their debut back in 2020 but had done 2 years worth of live music festivals. Yeah. And then we go into pandemic and we go into the expectation. Don't forget they were on James Corden's show. You know, so there was huge expectation around them. With this album, exactly what you say, all four are together, but it makes sense because they were working diligently.
I was going to say, explain the sort of schedule they had. You know, music is not a 9-to-5 job. Not true.
Not
in the case of Pillow Queens.
They locked themselves into a room from 9 to 5 for 5 to 6 weeks with a windowless room and got in there and started in I've listened or seen them kind of give some interviews where they're talking about how they didn't even speak. They just started moving musically together. Yeah. Then they went to County Clare.
There's the cohesion, isn't it, really?
Went to County Clare, had all of the songs finished and finalised before they went over to record it in the States, and they brought in a new producer, Colin Pastore. And what I think has happened here, and you can hear it in terms of every single instrument, every single production value, every single flourish has its own space, and none are fighting with each other.
Yep. Let's have a listen to a track called Gone. Simon, you can hear the hurt and the longing across these tracks. And, you know, Suffer, the title of one track, Gone, the one we've just been listening to, heavy pour, Notes on Worth. Yeah. At the end of it, you know, quite potent song titles. So you have that quality in there. But Kate mentioned the producer, Colin Pastore. Is that the key here, do you think?
It's tricky to see what has been the missing link. Because there's two things that have really, really changed here for me is that musically the production is just so good. And I think you're absolutely right. It's that kind of non-fussy production. But the second thing that's changed is that it's such a coherent story of an album as well. It's as if they've managed to do that, and I can only imagine when they sat down and listened to the album themselves the first time and went, this is what you're supposed to do with it. You know, it really is sort of beginning, middle and end stuff, and even the way it ends, because it kind of gets fairly bleak as it goes along, you know, but when it comes out at the end, it's almost as if you're seeing that little ray of sunshine behind a cloud.
Notes on Worth.
Yeah, it said, this is what you do.
Stars.
I think this is well worthy of 4 stars.
4. And Kate?
I'm exactly the same. I think it is. I think they're in an absolutely grown-up league. And I think if you're going to do a breakup album and a cathartic album, this is it. It's 4 out of 5. It's 4.5 out of 5.
It's 4.5. Yeah. Well, and that'll change, I'm guessing, over the weekend even. In an upward direction. Pillow Queens and Name Your Sorrow and Taylor Swift and the Tortured Poets Department. The first set of our albums this evening. We'll be talking about Wallace Bird and Pearl Jam shortly. But first of all, I have a wonderful competition for you this evening. Thursday, May the 9th, the RTE Concert Orchestra and conductor Martin Yates will bring Queen, a symphonic rock spectacular, to the National Concert Hall, and it will be there for one night only. Stars from the West End hit musical We Will Rock You will join a live rock band, backing vocalists, and of course the RTE Concert Orchestra in full arrangements of songs like We Are the Champions, Bohemian Rhapsody, Radio Gaga, lots more of course as well. You'll get full information on rte.ie/CO. We have a pair of tickets to give away to the show on Thursday, May the 9th, along with an overnight stay at the Hilton Hotel, just a 5-minute stroll from the heart of the city. Now, to be in with a chance of winning this prize, text your name and the answer to the following question to 51551. We'll announce the winner at the end of tonight's programme. Here is the question. What is the name of the 2018 biopic about the life of Freddie Mercury, which saw Rami Malek win an Academy Award for his portrayal of the legendary frontman? We're looking for the name of that film featuring Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury. 51551. And here we are back again. Simon Marr and Kate Brennan-Harding still with me, and we have 2 further albums to talk about. Big week for albums, but I suppose a lot of that was the sudden arrival of the Mammoth anthology from Taylor Swift. But three other quite big albums that we would have been speaking about anyway. We'll move on to Vision of Venus, musical project undertaken by singer-songwriter and musician Wallace Bird in collaboration with the contemporary German classical quintet Spark, to showcase 1,000 years of female composers. The Vision of Venus looks at composers from Clara Schumann to Joni Mitchell and Björk, and right back to Hildegard von Bingen. She's been in Germany, Simon Wallace Bird, for some time, obviously making all kinds of musical connections. Spark, it's Spark singular, the title of this quintet. They're essentially, they sound to me like a classical quintet. That's what they are.
That's exactly what they are. But I'd love to have been around the conversations where they sat down and they decided, do you know what we'll do over the course of an evening or over the course of an album? We'll explore all of the music of the last 1,000 years and pull 18 tracks out of that. So they pulled out what is a very successful live show out of it. And now the real challenge has been, and it's the sort of challenge that only somebody like Wallace Bird could take on, is the idea of, okay, how do we make this into an album, you know, and how do we interpret music that may have been released? I think some of the most recent tracks, you know, are sort of single number of years ago, but some of the eldest tracks that, you know, you're talking about The Guts 1098, I think, you know, was the first track that you're talking, you know, and how do we put all of that together?
Right, let us listen to, will we start? Yes, we'll start with the Kate Bush song, I think, because everybody's going to recognise this one. She wanted to take it further. There we go. The very recognisable Babushka, the Kate Bush song, in that version, which is on Wallace Bird and Spark's new album called Visions of Venus. I mean, it's not surprising that Kate Bush would be on there, but it is an 18-track album which comes from this live show. Mm. You were saying something very interesting about that as we were listening there, Kate.
Well, what I was saying is, so obviously that song is done beautifully, and I think that the quintet really kind of wrap around Wallace's voice. But one of the main things about this album, I don't think it's an album for an album's sake. I think it's about telling the story of womanhood and telling and honouring the story of women in the past and one man in the past who have celebrated, looked after, or been pioneers in the world of music and in the world of, you know, Wallace has written about Dr. Barry, who is
Dr. James Barry. Tell that story, that, you know, the essence of that story, because it kind of gives context to the
completely
song.
So Dr. James Barry is believed was a trans man and was the first person to in the Western world to do a performance cesarean. He learned it when he actually was in Africa from African tribe, and it's really fascinating. Like, Wallace actually released that song on International Women's Day, and Dr. Barry was renowned for also being kind, caring, passionate and interested in women's health. And women's health back then was always subservient to men's health. So, and the fact that James Barry was a trans man as well, or was, you know, is presumed lived life as a man. Mm. And in fairness, that was also to study medicine. But, you know,
not have been able to study medicine as a woman.
Exactly. But most historical contexts look at, no, he used he, him pronouns, and he was a trans man. And I think that in this album, in this body of work, recognizing all the different multitudes of people that have helped women or that have part of women's story that might have been written out of history and are being written back in. And I think that's what's important about this body of work.
And the title of the song about that particular person is simply called Dr. James Barry. That's Dr. James Barry from Wallace Bird and Spark's new album called Visions of Venus. And it's interesting, as I was listening in a new way, thinking of this live show. And there is a very performative aspect to that. You can see the stage show that might exist around it, Simon.
Absolutely.
You can hear it.
But you could imagine sort of being sitting in a room and not a pin dropping as some of these songs are played. And I think bringing so many of those stories and so many of those women to life, you know, there's something very, very special about it. But again, whether you're approaching the whole idea of doing this or then approaching the idea of how do I make this into a coherent album? Mm. And when we talked about Pillow Queens earlier on, we talked about that sort of story arc, that beginning, middle and end. And it's something like this, it is so, so difficult to do, and I'm not sure that right the way through the album that it ends up, you know, having something that kind of almost flow through it.
Yeah, because again, there are sections of this that are purely instrumental. There are tracks that are just instrumental. Now, in the midst of a live show, that makes total sense. Maybe there's, you know, a change of scenery or there's a change of dynamic on the stage, and a purely instrumental interlude almost is perfectly acceptable. Not sure, even though some of those pieces are absolutely beautiful, not sure how that works across an album. Kate.
Well, you see, I guess the more that we've actually had the conversation today about this, the more I'm kind of thinking, well, Wallace, first of all, is a magnificent storyteller. Yeah. If you've never seen Wallace live, the smile, the storytelling, and
totally charismatic.
Completely, but I would imagine is wrapping that story all around this. And the more I'm thinking about this album or this body of work, I'm seeing chapters. And I'm seeing that it's not necessarily supposed to be taken as an album, that it is chapters, and that we delve in and learn about the subject matter and elevate them and champion them. And that's what I'm beginning to see, I think, is more, for me, how I'm going
to
see it.
And I would like to have heard more of her guitar. I think we heard her guitar there on the Dr. James Barry track. Mm. We don't hear a lot of it across the album. It's mostly the quintet.
It's mostly the quintet, or it's Wallace's voice and then the percussion elements. You know, you sometimes hear Wallace hit her guitar, or you'll hear like little bangs and knocks on tables. But do you know, that also brings the live element into it, I think.
And there is a real subtlety to it. It is very nicely recorded.
Mm. I will listen to another track of it, however. Can I listen to a little bit of a Mirage?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. There we go. I wanted to play a little bit of that Amourage. Amy Beach, you were saying, is the composer there. And what the range of Wallace Bird's voice across this album. And I'm hearing pure music theatre, and I'm seeing the show as much as I'm hearing an album in this one. Overall, does it work? And what are you saying stars-wise? I'll come to you first on this one, Kate.
So for me, I do think that people should take a listen and dive in from the perspective of maybe looking at the chapters and honouring the women in it. As an album, I'm giving it 3 out of 5, but there are some 4 out of 5 moments throughout.
Yeah, there are some amazing tracks. No,
I think that's very, very fair. If nothing else, it will pique your curiosity. Even with me, it was one of those things. I thought I knew very, very little about music, and now, as I hear more of these stories, it's like, you know even less than you thought you did. So it is a worthy 3.
Yeah, and it would send you back to find out more about the particular women and the man involved. All right, let us move on to album number 4 from Pearl Jam. 12th studio album. It's called Dark Matter. This is the title track. There we go. Right back in the 1990s all of a sudden. A boat, Kate Brennan Harding, which I think you purposely watched float away from the dock and didn't bother climbing onto.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So you arrived to this album with what kind of expectations of Pearl Jam?
Well, so the thing is, I have to be, as a music reviewer, you have to take on the music at face value. But like when you're a teenager and your babysitter loves Pearl Jam and they're that year and a half older than you and you decide that you will never like them, just for stubbornness, not for any other reason, and you go into the Oasis Britpop dynamic, Pearl Jam are this inaccessible kind of band for me. Yeah. But I have to say, I know, like, obviously 10, it's 33 years or something.
Yeah, 91, yeah.
And there are songs on it that my wife has brought into my life that I now love, okay? So I now am embracing them. This album, I have to say, do you know the way we have bands that are, you know, going 30, 40, 50 years, and sometimes they're trying to hark back to the past and their glory days? There's something about this album that I will say, and I think hats off, they're not trying to be something different. They're not trying to reignite the old days. They're just, I think, out here enjoying themselves in some of the chapters.
I mean, they were a defining moment in terms of grunge, really.
Oh, they absolutely were. And even though at the time they were seen, I think Kurt Cobain called them corporate puppets and said they were supermarket grunge. And there was all of that that they got at the time while selling copies of 10 by the million.
Millions.
But they did spend quite a period of time then, sort of in that later part of the 1990s and into the 2000s, 2010s, trying to possibly recreate 10. Mm. And it was the wrong thing to do. But as Kate says, they have now obviously decided, look, this is what we are. This is now what we do. And this is what we enjoy doing it. And when they do that, they do it well.
And I was saying, most of the tracks in this are quite grungy, but every so often you get a little bit of kind of acoustic. You go, what's that band?
Oh, always.
Where did they come from?
But they're always what, and it was always one of the bizarre things about a Pearl Jam record and a Pearl Jam gig as well. They were one of those bands that midway through the set, the rest of the band would go off stage.
Yeah.
And then it would be Eddie and the chap with an acoustic guitar, and they do a couple of those sort of tunes.
Yeah, and there's a couple of those on this. And Eddie Vedder's vocals, what do you think? What state are they in at this point in time?
I think Eddie Vedder's vocals are sounding incredibly strong and very Eddie Vedder-ish. But there are sometimes some things in the way he sings that I think is probably my misophonia or something that I'd like to be able to hear him enunciate a bit more. But I do recognise that he is a voice of a generation.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, though, and it's funny, like every album we've talked about, in nearly every album we talk about the producer, Andrew Watt is the producer on this. This man has the absolute Midas touch. He produced Iggy Pop only, I think, last year, Every Loser, and that was an absolutely brilliant album.
Has he been a long-term producer with them?
No, he's new with them, but he's got a speciality of sort of bringing bands and acts like Iggy Pop that are older and making them sound relevant with little flourishes. He's also a Dua Lipa producer and a Miley Cyrus producer.
You liked the final track on the album?
I did like the final track on the album, but it was because it's a good song, it's slower, it's Americana, and I just, you know, Eddie Vedder is actually singing a little bit differently in it.
Yeah. And I wonder, does the title Setting Sun tell us about any Pearl Jam intentions? Let us have a listen. I was saying, when I was listening to that track initially, I thought, that's such a cool track at the end of an album. You'd love to have a cool uncle who could sing a track like Eddie Vedder, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would, absolutely would, but nobody has that cool of an uncle. But there
Eddie Vedder's nephews and nieces.
Absolutely, but he's around. But there is something about Pearl Jam and something about the way that they've always done it. And I think they spent 10 years trying too hard, and they don't try too hard, and the results are so much better. And it means that they can get away with 35 years later, you know, having something like Dark Matter, you know, it's real, real driving rock stuff, and then having Setting Sun at the end.
Yeah, okay. And is it the Setting Sun, do you think?
I don't think for a second. And I think when you see the crowd, you'll see them at Marley Park.
And the sun that sets today rises tomorrow. Let us remember that. Stars from you on this one, Simon.
I am going to give this, I like this more than I thought it would, so I'm going to give this 3.5 out of 5.
3.5 out of 5. Are you thinking about getting the return trip boat? Not letting it sail away from the dock now.
Well, I haven't had a choice because, as I said, my wife loves them.
It's arrived in the house.
Yeah, I have to say, I did enjoy this parts of this album. Not all of it, but parts of it. For me, it's a 3 out of 5. I think people who are Pearl Jam fans will absolutely love it. People who are not Pearl Jam fans probably have other bands that they're invested in. But I think there's loads of merit to this album.
Well, there you go. So fairly even Stevens there this evening. And Kate Brennan and Hardy and Simon are very busy listening week and a very busy listening Friday with the arrival of the Taylor Swift album. So Pearl Jam's Dark Matter, Wallace Bird's Visions of Venus, Pillow Queen's Name Your Sorrow, and Taylor Swift, The Tortured Poets Department, The Anthology, were the four albums that Kate Brennan Harding and Simon Marr are speaking to us about this evening. In 1997, journalist Mitch Albom turned a series of meetings with his terminally ill sociology professor into a best-selling memoir, Tuesdays with Maury. A film from the book, starring Jack Lemmon and Hank Azaria, followed. And this week, the stage adaptation arrived at the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin. Dan Butler plays Maury Schwartz, a retired professor who has motor neuron disease. And Stephen Jones plays Mitch, his former student, who is now a successful sports writer. Chris O'Rourke was at the Gaiety Theatre for us. He's with me in studio this evening. It is an interesting dynamic here, how the kind of the teacher pupil dynamic in a different place. How did they know each other initially, the real life characters of Mitch and Maury?
It's very much as you described. He was one of his students in the sociology department, and just he took a shine to him.
As in, who took the shine to whom?
The best way to describe it, it was like a sort of a surrogate father figure, is how it felt.
Yeah.
As in, Maury seemed to see something in Mitch and wanted to cultivate it and took a shine to him. But that relationship got parked, we'll say, for 16 years because he went off into the world. I think part of the attraction was that Mitch was a pianist. He was really into music, and I think Maury wanted him to cultivate his artistic passion. But of course, the real life steps in. And then when they meet 16 years later, he's this workaholic, high-powered sports writer.
And do we have a sense that, you know, so he parked the piano playing when he was younger. Do we have a sense that he's fundamentally kind of dissatisfied, or there's a bundle of regrets in there that if he goes back to talk to this man, he's going to have to face?
You know, I think you've nailed it on the head, because that's very much the sense of it. He doesn't even seem to know how much he regrets. He just knows there's a need. Basically, Maury was hugely loved, and there was this TV special where he became aware that he had motor neurons disease and he was dying.
And we've got to remember, this is a true story.
This is a true story.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, so when he sees it, he reaches out just to kind of come and pay his respects, he thinks. And out of that arises this series of weekly meetings, no points for guessing which day, where they get together, they have a chat, and you realise that Mitch is a huge success in so many ways, but his life is not a success.
And do you have a sense that Maury, even on that first visit, I'm thinking of the film now as much as anything else, I think there's a sense that Maury, when he arrives, goes, finally we get to speak. I've been waiting for this moment.
Exactly. And it's done incredibly well in the play. It's, you know, it's a very simply written play. You know, there's not a lot of action. We know where it's going to go. So there's a real sense you get that where he says goodbye, it's like, I'll see you, And he comes back 16 years later. It's like moments later for Murray.
Yeah.
It's like, ah, here you are.
Yeah.
So it's like he picks up where they left off.
Dan Butler plays Murray here. I suppose lots of people know him as Bulldog from the TV series.
Yes.
Fraser. A very different character, I would have thought,
from
Murray.
You know something? He is fabulous. He does a fantastic job. One of the things that I wasn't aware of when I read the book, for example, is the Jewish humour that's there, that Butler brings out brilliant. He's almost like a Jackie Mason kind of rabbi-style jokes. And that works incredibly well. But I think, as you said, because everybody associates him with this kind of misogynistic loudmouth.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden to see him playing this very soft, caring, all the feels professor, you really get a sense of his range as an actor, and he's incredibly, incredibly good in the role.
Yeah, and I mean, what often happens, or a trap that an actor could fall into in that situation is, they're for the Bulldog character, they're full of energy and pizzazz and they have all the laugh lines. In this then, you still have to have the energy up there, but with a much less flashy character.
He does, and that's where Stephen Jones, I think, works incredibly well, because this is like a Batman Robin situation, and Stephen Jones, who I won't say always looks comfortable playing the American high motivated American guy, but he looks incredibly comfortable supporting Murray. As in, he knows he's Robin to
his
Batman.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sets him up beautifully so that Murray's able to come back with these words of wisdom, this homespun wisdom about life, about relationships, most importantly about dying and death. And Jones does a terrific job there as well.
Yeah, and I suppose the real strength here is the writing, and you've got to recognise that from Mitch Albom, obviously.
Yeah.
But also what he was writing was the words that Murray had spoken.
Exactly.
What makes them so... You know, what made the book such a success, the film such a success, and this play has been in a million and one productions around the world? What has made all of them such successes?
To be honest with you, I think there's a number of factors to that. I think, first of all, this is a very American piece of work. There's a lot of Americana references in it. So the Americans absolutely went wild for it. And of course, once they go wild, everybody's going to go wild. But the second thing is, it's got this adorable charm. It's a little twee. It's a little sentimental. But at its heart, it's like It's a Wonderful Life. It has this charm. Mm. And it what it does, I think, that gives it a bit of a spine is it puts things like motor neuron disease and actually facing into death out there. But it does it in a way where, yeah, it's a little sentimental, but you're aware that this has actually happened. This is what it can be like. So you're getting something that doesn't batter you over the head, but it makes you engage with something you may not normally see in a beautiful way.
And so, obviously, it's a constant trip. Every Tuesday, Mitch comes to visit Murray. So it's all in the one location.
Yeah.
As the mutant neuron disease is progressing, obviously the facility for movement, etc., becomes less and less and less.
Yeah.
How is the stage set out and designed to facilitate that kind of enclosing and, you know, a drama that gets smaller and smaller in terms of space, but maybe bigger and bigger in terms of content?
It's, to be honest, the Kieran Bagnall said it almost looks like this snow globe, like you're looking inside a snow globe. So it's a contained space anyway. They have a piano outside of the space, which you see, but obviously the action takes place in it. And what happens is he moves from a chair into a sort of a bed. It's what I suppose what it really is, it's Dan Butler's performance that gets that constriction, that sense of being less physical, being less able to talk, less able to move, which is compensated by Jones being maybe a little bit hyperactive around it. So you get a contrast of movement. So it's I would put it down mostly to the performances rather than the design that gives you that real sense of diminishment that you're talking about.
And again, direction often, good direction is totally invisible. Yes. Andy Arnold is the director here, but if you're talking about the performances, you saw the performances, you didn't see some big directorial hand moving puppets.
Exactly, and I think that's essential, because you with this, you want it to work its magic. You want it to work its charm. And if you're too conscious of the technical thing, you know, this is a play you have to, you know, get a little bit lost in. And it does that very, very well.
The other thing is, and again, that the tragedy of these situations is Maury, was it Maury who loved to, or is it Mitch who loved to do the dancing and play music?
Maury loved to dance, Mitch loved,
Mitch loved to play the music.
Yeah.
And obviously that becomes, as the motor neuron disease progresses, that becomes more and more of an issue.
They do it very well, and again, this is what I mean. They don't hammer you over the head with it.
Yeah.
In the beginning, there's a sense of what we see Dan Butler dancing to the very thought of you as Stephen Jones is playing it on piano, and it's a lovely little moment. It's just a little sentimental, but it's a lovely moment. But what they do is they leave it at that. They don't keep hammering you with it, so it starts to linger like a memory, and you go, it's there, but it's over. There's a sadness to recalling it rather than seeing it again all the time. So it's that thing where they leave the audience to fill in a number of blanks and make the connections.
And it also strikes me, you know, even in, obviously Mitch Albom decided to write a book here the book was a huge, big financial
success.
Apparently
it's the biggest selling memoir of all time.
So how do you how did he, and how does this play, and how did the film treat this incredibly difficult subject without being exploitative in any way?
I think probably because Albom doesn't put himself front and centre. He puts Maury front and centre. He puts the dying and the death front and centre. And it's as if he holds up his hand and says, I thought I was a success. I wasn't. This man made me reevaluate my life, and he can do the same for you. So have a listen to what he has to say as opposed to what I have to say.
And does Maury get something in return for that? I mean, to impart that type of wisdom and to facilitate one character's development in that way. Is there a reverse payoff?
There is. I don't want to spoil it for you. Yeah. There's a beautiful line at the end with Stevens-Jones where you kind of get, oh, I think I see what the real payoff for Maury was. But at least, the very least, there's a sense he gets companionship. But he's a natural teacher. Mm. He's a natural giver. So there's also this sense of having a purpose and a value in the Mitch character coming there, sitting there, listening to his wisdom and recording it.
Yeah.
So I think, he gets a lot out of it as well.
I'm getting the sense that you had a great evening at the theatre. Were there any caveats?
It depends. I think it's not serious theatre. It's not Shakespeare. The play is very, very simple. It's sweet, not overly sweetened. It's cheesy. It's like a bit of cheesecake, let's put it to you that way, okay? And it's adorable and it's very, very tasty. And I think, though, people who might sort of think it's a bit twee and sentimental, I would say then maybe take a cheat day from your serious theatre, go and enjoy this, because it's very, very enjoyable.
All right, very enjoyable is the Judgment of Chris O'Rourke on Tuesdays with Maury, which runs at the Gaiety Theatre through until April the 27th. It then tours to the Everyman Theatre in Cork, 30th of April through until May the 2nd, and the Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny, it's there on May the 3rd. Tonight's competition, we asked you about the 2018 biopic about the life of Freddie Mercury, which saw Rami Malek win an Academy Award for his portrayal of the legendary frontman. What was the name of that film? Bohemian Rhapsody was the name of that film. Katie Walsh in Galway will be going to hear the RT Concert Orchestra on Thursday, May the 9th at the National Concert Hall, and she will be getting her overnight stay in the Hilton Hotel as well. Congratulations to you, Katie. And that is our lot for this Friday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Niall Fitzmaurice researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was in sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan.